From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On November 2nd, filmmaker Theo van Gogh was murdered in Amsterdam. The man charged with the crime is a Dutch-Moroccan Muslim extremist. The motive? A film that van Gogh had made called Submission about the treatment of women under Islam.
For the Dutch, it was a moment of reckoning. Suddenly, the country found itself struggling with its long, proud tradition of tolerance, and its resolutely politically correct press would have to raise those questions and report on the debate. The media throughout the West are in the midst of developing a vocabulary to address the issues raised by the culture clash between rapidly expanding Muslim communities and their host nations.
Back in the Netherlands last week, the popular right-wing politician Geert Wilders called for a 5-year halt to non-Western immigration, saying that the country had been tolerant of intolerant people for too long. Meanwhile, a wave of violence committed by and against Muslims has consumed the country. Martin Walker is the editor-in-chief of United Press International. He's been reading the papers in the Netherlands and around Europe, and he says the Dutch press reflects the anguish of that nation.
On the front page of Algemeen Dagblad, one of the great daily papers of Holland, they had the front page editorial to the Queen saying, "Your Majesty, please speak to us, your people. Hate is spreading like wildfire through the country. Mosques, churches, schools, children are targets of attack. The Netherlands is in danger of becoming a country of them and us. Your Majesty, please speak."
The New York Times described that the Dutch have been almost tongue-tied in their inability to deal with their conflicting feelings.
But what they're all trying to agree upon is that there has to be absolutely no compromise with the fact that this was a vicious murder and that there are ruthless Islamic extremists who have to be brought under control. To that extent, some of the old easy, knee-jerk, liberal response towards integration and immigration really has become bypassed by the realities of what's been taking place in Holland. And that's also, I think, been happening in much of the rest of Europe, where there has long been a fairly unthinking political correctness saying that there should be a welcome for immigrants. After all, we need them. Labor, they should be allowed to maintain their culture. And it began to go very sour, I think, with the elections in France 18 months ago when the Front National of Jean-Marie Le Pen became the challenger to Jacques Chirac, when we've seen in Germany the rise of far-right parties, of frankly a neo-Nazi party in Germany, far-right parties emerging also in Britain. We've seen them in Belgium become the biggest single party in the Flemish part of Belgium.
And leave us not forget Austria.
Let's not forget Denmark either, where they're also terribly powerful. And as a result, what we've seen in traditionally liberal newspapers, to give you one example, one of the most liberal papers of all is Sweden's Expression, says that they entirely support the way the Dutch government has declared war on Islamic terrorism. It might be a risk, but it's a risk that has to be taken because the threat of a growing division in Dutch society and in Europe more widely would have been much greater had the authorities not reacted. The kind of political extremism which van Gogh's murderers represent is just as dangerous as that of the communist terrorists of the 1970s or of neo-Nazis, and we have to be very, very clear about that. In Germany, Die Welt, we can now see that the liberal European belief in building communities like a little Istanbul or a little Marrakesh are in fact turning into Europe's own nightmare of a little Gaza, a little Baghdad, here in the Netherlands. Someday it might become a little Fallujah. Europe has to accept the prospect of serious clashes with Islamic extremists. And if governments are unable to react appropriately, Europe will not only face the feared clash of civilizations, we will also face the prospect of an increasingly strong far right that is going to be too strong to be stopped.
It's such a striking situation. In the U.S., of course, we face similar tensions, trying to preserve civil liberties and to protect the idea of the melting pot, while simultaneously trying to protect our borders and our people from terrorism. Is Europe and the European press now getting a taste of the American dilemma?
There has long been this feeling in Europe of rather smug superiority vis-a-vis America, that America was the place that had the racial problems, the civil rights problems, and there was liberal Europe without such difficulties, and suddenly they're realizing that they've been living in a dream world. And what we're seeing is not simply the actual conflict with Islamic extremism, but we're also seeing, I think, a real tussle with the traditions of political correctness. You see, for example, in Die Welt, our states in Europe have hitherto allowed extremists to create networks under the protection of the so-called communal dialogue, the beneficiaries of whom have had only one goal, to live in accordance with their own rules and cancel out ours, to abolish our constitutional state. We cannot afford to let that happen. Theo van Gogh was not alone in starting to do fairly hard-hitting films, TV documentaries, radio programs. In Britain, something that we've seen over the last year has been a couple of documentaries on honor killings by Islamic fathers of daughters whose offense was simply to date European or British boys whom they'd met at school. Something of the same kind has been taking place in France, where we've had a couple of TV documentaries on a phenomenon called the tournon, in effect a gang rape of a French girl by young Muslim boys. And there's some claim that in some parts of Muslim society this has become almost a rite of passage for adolescents. These things are maybe very isolated examples, but in the mood of Europe at the moment, they have simply mushroomed and become very, very explosive urban legends, and ones that I think are going to have a really important impact upon coming elections. I think Europe's in for a very, very tricky period.
Martin, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Martin Walker is editor-in-chief of United Press International.
This week, CBS announced that its evening news anchor, the man who had held that post for an unprecedented 24 years, would be signing off on March 9th. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Rather is leaving the building.
This is the CBS Evening News, with Dan Rather reporting from CBS News headquarters in New York.
Good evening. Danger. War. Killer. Fraud. CIA. Mayhem. Crisis. Horrible. Inflation.
Military threat.
The flaming debris. Fatal heart attack.
It would have been tough for anyone to take the mantle from the person once voted most trusted man in America. But though it was hotly contested, Bill Leonard, then head of CBS News, called it for Rather.
I'm delighted to announce that Dan Rather will succeed Walter Cronkite as anchorman and managing editor of the CBS Evening News in early 1981.
I seek to be in the Walter Cronkite mold, in the Ed Murrow mold before him. To the best of my abilities, I want to be an honest broker of information.
Well, let me, I'll just add a word to that. I don't think that with Dan taking over the CBS Evening News, there's any problem of transition.
But despite Cronkite's reassuring words, there may have been a problem or two. At the time, some thought veteran newsman Roger Mudd was the heir apparent, passed over because he wasn't as pretty as Rather. And though Cronkite denies it, there were rumors that Uncle Walter was being rushed into retirement because Rather threatened to switch networks. In that scenario, reminiscent of the film All About Eve, Rather plays a rising star who ruthlessly pushes her mentor out of the way. We don't know about that, but the film's famous quip still works.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
In Dan's case, that night lasted 24 years. He walked off a newscast when it was delayed by a tennis match. He was attacked by a man on Park Avenue who asked, "Kenneth, where is the frequency?" He briefly ended his newscasts with the word courage, causing waggish competitors like Bryant Gumbel to sign off with Mazel Tov and hot dogs. And if you can't remember those bumps in Rather's road, you have only to cast your mind back to the monumental pothole he drove over last September, that 60 Minutes 2 story about the president's dubious National Guard record, and those equally dubious memos used to back that story up.
Are those documents authentic, as experts consulted by CBS News continue to maintain? Or were they forgeries or recreations? We will keep an open mind, and we will continue to report credible evidence and responsible points of view as we try to answer the questions raised about the authenticity of the documents.
And a week later...
I made a mistake. I didn't dig hard enough, long enough, didn't ask enough of the right questions.
Here was proof positive, or perhaps just the latest in a career-long series of proofs positive, that Dan Rather had a liberal bias. But reporters are people, too, and everyone, with the exception of Jim Lehrer, has some kind of bias. They just try not to let it show. Cronkite rarely did. When he pronounced the Vietnam War unwinnable, the Johnson administration gasped. Despite a few suppressed tears when President Kennedy died, Cronkite was always clear-eyed and steady in the tradition of network newsmen he helped to establish. Dan was different. He let it show. He let everything show. As at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
I know you won't, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you plan to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute. Well, Walters, you can see.
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people apparently around Dan.
And after the Twin Towers fell on September 11th, 2001.
If they could go down to Ground Zero and see the following. See those firemen? Take it for a minute, will you?
He was emotional, excitable, occasionally obnoxious. Even when confronting famously combative presidents like Richard Nixon, he just couldn't put a sock in it.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. Are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
He didn't like Nixon. We know that. There was hardly anything about Dan Rather we didn't know if we watched regularly, and millions did. He was a bit of a loon, especially on election night. Oh, those Ratherisms.
You'd have to say this thing is as tight as the rusted lug nuts on a 55 Ford.
As he explained to David Letterman.
I grew up around people who talk this way.
Oh, I see. So all of these are you just recall them from your experience?
Yeah, and during the year, if I hear something that I say to myself, you know, that's colorful language, and I think I could use it election night.
I never met anyone who talked like that, but I believe him when he says he did. Rather is believable because he is so raw. The first and only extreme anchor in network news. In a time when journalists are suspected of secretly harboring opinions, Rather, consciously or not, goes with full disclosure. In an era when anchors are processed and poured into a mold like Velveeta, Rather is pungent and runny. He hyped and sentimentalized coverage, but I do not agree with the critics who say that Dan Rather, in all his discombobulated liberalness, compromised the integrity of network news. If anything sinks that once great institution, it won't be leftiness or even craziness. It'll be cowardice. Come to think of it, 18 years ago, when Rather intoned courage at the end of his newscasts, maybe he wasn't talking to us.
Up next, the vast amounts of money it takes to keep mainstream music terrible, and the terrible music that gets trapped in your brain.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A few weeks ago, New York State Attorney General Eliot Spitzer issued subpoenas to the four big music conglomerates investigating how songs earn or buy radio play. Spitzer's investigation shed light on one of the oldest problems in pop music, payola. Payola had its heyday in the 1950s when a handful of disc jockeys were convicted of taking money in exchange for playing a few potential hits. Many thought the practice had gone the way of rigging game shows, but it seems to have merely changed form. James Surowiecki wrote about modern payola for the New Yorker magazine, and he joins us now. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So what is modern payola?
Well, the simple idea of payola, of course, is record labels paying radio stations in order to get their records on the air. And modern payola takes a variety of forms. The simplest form, which I think is the one that Spitzer is really trying to investigate, are record labels use these people called independent promoters who basically funnel money to radio stations via a variety of means. They pay for things that they call research funds. They give gifts in kind. They'll throw big events, etc., in order to kind of basically push their records, at least get their records on the horizon. And then there's this other interesting form, which has gained a lot of notice recently, which are called spot buys.
And that's legal.
That's totally legal. And basically what a spot buy is essentially a record label will buy big chunks of airtime. One of the examples I wrote about was Avril Lavigne's record label basically bought radio time on a series of stations around the country. And they would just play the song over and over again, like three, four times an hour.
you say that this kind of legal payola is worse than the illegal kind.
Well, you know, the traditional form of payola back in the 1950s, when famously, you know, Alan Freed, who was one of the first real rock and roll DJs, was eventually accused and indicted for taking bribes to play records. That payola, what that actually did was break a lot of interesting records. There's a real good argument to be made that a lot of black music...
You mean break them into the...
Into the mainstream, yeah, I'm sorry. Break them as hits, not smash them. That Chuck Berry, people like that, would maybe never have become the pop icons they became had it not been for payola. Because what it did was it allowed these relatively unknown artists to get played. The problem with this kind of spot buy payola is that it actually has nothing to do with real popularity. It has nothing to do with breaking new artists. It really is just an attempt to game a completely corrupt system, which is the Billboard ranking system. And it really serves no purpose other than to kind of artificially create popularity.
Well, let's talk about the Billboard ranking service because, as you noted in your piece, this is how radio stations, many of them, determine their playlists. And if people buy spot ads, basically buy the time to play those songs, it still counts on the Billboard chart.
Yeah, that's the most perplexing part of this. And it's sort of hard to keep in your head, but if you think about it, all Billboard is basically recording is how many times individual songs are played. And for some bizarre reason, they do not distinguish between records that are played because some DJ decides to play them and records that are played because a record label has bought the time. So that's a huge flaw and loophole in the ranking system. And that's what these labels are trying to exploit.
But paying for placement is acceptable in other markets. Coke pays to have its soda displayed prominently in the supermarket. Publishers do the same in bookstores. Why not music on the radio?
Well, I think the reason why we accept it in supermarkets and we accept it in bookstores, although the truth is most people don't know about it in bookstores, is that radio is a weird medium. A song is an advertisement for itself. The record labels give these songs to radio stations, effectively, pay small royalty, so that people will hear them and then say, oh, I got to buy the album. But at the same time, radio is kind of art as well. You know, we don't want it to be corrupt.
But let's talk about transparency then, because you make a big point in your piece of saying that legal payola is fully disclosed. If the record company that owns Avril Lavigne's records pays for those airplays, the public hears that they're being paid for. Does that make a difference?
Well, it certainly makes a difference legally. As long as payola is acknowledged, it is legal. And these Avril Lavigne songs, at the end, they would say, you know, this has been sponsored by, or at the beginning.
So instead, we have this legal and above board system whereby big companies can pay for play and thereby queer the Billboard charts that all the stations look at to determine what they're going to play. So is there any way to know what the public really likes?
That's a really fascinating question because I think at this point it's a sort of circular logic going on here. Popular songs get played, but what gets played is what becomes popular, etc. So it is very hard to figure out exactly what the audience wants to hear. I do think that Billboard, and it mystifies me why they have not done this, should just change their ranking system. It would not be hard to do. The spot buys have to be acknowledged, so they have to be recorded. Billboard should just exclude those, and then we'd still be with this radically impure system, but it would be a lot better than what we've ended up with.
What does the conventional wisdom tell us about whether it's possible to create a hit simply by playing a song a lot?
I think conventional wisdom probably would tell us that you can buy hits. I actually don't fully believe that. It's certainly possible to push songs higher up than they would normally be. I feel about it a little bit the way I feel about movies. It's very easy to open a movie big, but it's very hard to create a movie that actually endures over time. And I think with records, it's probably pretty close to the same thing.
Jim, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
James Surowiecki is author of The Wisdom of Crowds and columnist for The New Yorker magazine.
Last week, the major record labels trade group filed copyright infringement lawsuits against another 761 users of online peer-to-peer file trading networks, bringing the total to nearly 7,000 lawsuits filed. At the same time, Atlanta-based research firm Big Champagne reported that more Americans than ever, nearly 20 million of them, are using peer-to-peers. For the 5 years that networks like Napster have come and gone and come again, their fans have been saying one of the prime attractions is the availability of music that isn't on the shelves at big-box retail stores and isn't being played on commercial radio. Rick Carr reports that the business model used by major labels has driven musicians and fans to the peer-to-peers and to other new technologies.
Every generation seems to hear the decline of Western civilization in the next generation's pop music. But apocalyptic visions of the aging aside, the aesthetics of pop music have changed over the past couple decades, in large part due to changing business realities in the music industry. Harold Vogel is a New York financial analyst and author of Entertainment Industry Economics, a textbook that's just gone into its sixth edition. He says the changes have affected the record business and radio in the same way.
There's a cycle of, let's say, protectionism and risk aversion, and we're in the depth of that right now. There's certainly a lot of risk aversion. If it isn't popular in 12 different markets, why should we play it? And nobody wants to play the unpopular or the new or the different.
Vogel says the risk-averse phase of that business cycle is a long hangover of sorts from the industry's huge expansion in the 1960s and 70s. The baby boomers set off a boom in the record industry, rewarding labels that took risks on new talent by making those artists into bankable stars. Vogel says record labels got used to strong cash flow and big profits, so when the boom tapered off in the late 70s, the industry scrambled to sustain profitability. One solution came from sales of the new compact discs. A lot of music fans bought their record collections all over again. The other way to sustain profits was to cut costs, and so the record industry started to consolidate. Conglomerates snapped up independent labels, and major labels merged. The conglomerates set earnings targets and borrowed a page from the movie business's playbook, the tentpole release. Vogel says that's what Hollywood calls a film that's supposed to be a blockbuster that props up the studio's finances.
An expensive picture, high marketing, high production value, lots of big stars. And all your other pictures, your other 15 pictures or so, would fall under the tent, basically. This would carry the season and be the thing you talk about to your shareholders in the annual report that you write the next spring.
The same pressures drive tentpole releases in the record business. At least once a quarter, says former Mercury and Warner Brothers chief Danny Goldberg, you have to have a big hit.
When you look at a schedule and you know you have to make whatever the number is for your company, $200 million or $300 million or $400 million for the year in terms of your top line of sales, something you can chip a million of is $10 million of those dollars. And almost the same amount of staff time goes into setting up a release where you ship a million as setting up a release where you ship 100,000.
By extension, a record that sells 10 million copies is an even better financial proposition. Goldberg says that makes it harder for major labels to take risks and puts a premium on releases by bankable stars. Labels pay bigger and bigger cash advances to those stars and spend millions promoting their releases to retailers and radio broadcasters. But
the more resources that go into that, the less resources are available for the development of new talent.
Even established stars suffer if their records sell only, say, a few hundred thousand copies. The business model at today's major labels, Goldberg says, can't accommodate an act like the Pretenders, who released two platinum and one gold album at their peak in the 1980s.
You've changed, your place in this world.
But the business models at smaller independent labels are designed to support acts like that. And in fact, the Pretenders are now signed to Goldberg's 4.5-year-old Artemis Records. Goldberg says independent labels have traditionally been where new artists go to build their careers.
We're just putting out our second album by somebody named Jesse Malin. I'm very excited about the first album. Did about 30,000, but got good press, created some good interest at some parts of the media, and he's a brilliant guy. I think a major label might have spent more on the last record in terms of things like tour support, but they might not have made the second record.
Goldberg says that throughout the history of the music business, independent labels have gone through cycles of their own, releasing jazz, R&B, rock and roll, and punk when the majors were avoiding risk. Once the new genres became popular, the majors swooped in and co-opted them. The downside of the independent label, Goldberg says, is that it has a much harder time marketing artists like Jesse Malin by getting them played on commercial radio, an industry that went through its own cycle of consolidation and risk aversion in the 90s. But Danny Goldberg is bullish on the ability of new technologies to make up for the lack of radio exposure. He likes satellite radio, and he's a big fan of the subscription internet service Rhapsody, which allows users to listen to a library of hundreds of thousands of songs for a flat monthly fee. Even the peer-to-peer networks, the scourge of the major labels, are proving to be places where smaller artists can get some attention. Consider the Seattle-based trio The Jeunes. They've only played 14 shows, none of them outside the Pacific Northwest, but they have a passionate new fan 4,695 miles away in Derby, England. Musician and DJ Jyoti Mishra.
I found out about their music because I downloaded it. I thought illegally. Turns out they'd posted it themselves to try and get better known.
Mishra says the Jeunes are one of thousands of bands taking part in an online renaissance of pop music, recording at home and, if they're lucky, gathering fans from among the millions who troll the internet looking for music.
People aren't waiting around for permission from major labels to have a career. They're having their own career themselves. It may be tiny, it may be very locally based, it may be internet based, but they're not waiting around or spending their whole lives chasing some dream of being signed and getting some big thing happen.
But Mishra knows firsthand that the major labels still dominate one thing, marketing. They have the clout and the money to grab media attention in a crowded marketplace. His song, Your Woman, recorded under the name Whitetown, got him picked off a small independent label and onto the major EMI Records. In 1997, it went to number one in 8 countries and sold more than 1 million singles and albums worldwide. Without EMI, it would probably never have sold more than a few thousand copies. 7 years later, Jyoti Mishra says technology is at least starting to give musicians and music fans a choice. They no longer have to buy into the major label's business model. For On the Media, I'm Rick Carr in New York.
Did you ever have a tune burrow into your brain? Experts call it an earworm, and it can sound like this. Last summer, in his continuing battle against noise pollution, New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg had proposed banning that theme from city streets, where it spills forth all summer long from Mr. Softy ice cream trucks. Think of the mayor as exterminator, nozzle trained on a public infestation of earworm. I remember the first time I had one. I was 9 years old. My Boy Lollipop was number 2 on the hit parade, and it made my heart go giddy-app until I was ready to dash my brains out. It took me years to get rid of it. Even now, it sneaks back if I'm tired. But it could have been worse. That nightmare tune appeared on a list of top 10 earworms compiled last year by University of Cincinnati marketing professor James Kolaris with the help of his students. As you might have guessed, songs with lyrics stick most, followed by commercial jingles and instrumental tunes. Kolaris found that most episodes last for hours. Those poor kids.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight.
In June of 1985, 2 young climbers attempted to scale a peak in the Peruvian Andes. As told in the book and documentary Touching the Void, one of them fell into a crevasse and was presumed dead. At one point, he almost wished he was, because of an earworm.
I did have one time when I got a song going through my head.
and it was by a band called Boney M. And I don't really like Boney M's music. And it just went on and on and on for hours. I found it very upsetting because I wanted to try and get out of my head. I was thinking, you know, bloody hell, I'm going to die to Boney M.
They say that musicians, women, and neurotics are most susceptible to earworm. But according to the San Francisco Gate, Mark Twain once wrote a short story about a, quote, jingling rhyme that became indelibly lodged in the author's mind until he passed it on to another hapless victim. But does that really work? They say breathing into a paper bag can cure hiccups, but can no one rid me of this meddlesome tune? Yes, it turns out Neva Grant, a senior producer at NPR's Morning Edition, has the cure.
Yes, I do, Brooke. It is the song America from the musical West Side Story. You deploy this particular antidote when the song that's stuck in your head is so bad that even hearing I like to be in America over and over again is better than what was ever there before. Because you need something forceful to kind of push whatever the other thing is firmly out of the way.
So there you have it, folks. An end to misery. But don't thank me yet. It may not work for you. Even worse, you might not be able to get America out of your head. In that case, blame Neva.
Coming up, a song you will probably have no trouble getting out of your head. I know. I wrote it.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Some years back, Bob had a speaking engagement in Nashville. Being an exquisitely sensitive person, he was seized by the vibrations emanating from the Grand Ole Opry, as well as visions of fortune and fame. This is what happened.
I was going to be in Nashville for a day and a half, and my speaking gig wasn't going to tie me up for long, so I figured, while I'm in town, why not just write a hit country song and get it cut by a major recording star? I mean, I am a writer. I live in a country. How hard could it be?
Lovely lily, it's so fair. Hazel eyes, golden hair. Climb the branches of your family tree. Your mama's roots are in Tennessee.
So I did what most aspiring musicians do as soon as they hit Nashville. I found my way to the Bluebird Cafe. Open mic nights there have launched the careers of Garth Brooks, Vince Gill, Mary Chapin Carpenter, and more guitar playing songwriters than you can shake a pick at. They duck in from the rain and sing about their pain, you might say if you were a professional songwriter such as myself, displaying their charms for Opryland's waiting arms. Singer-songwriter Ashley Cleveland was born and raised up just down the road a piece, an advantage I don't have. I was born in Philadelphia and live in Washington. In other words, I'm an outsider, which suddenly struck me as a potential impediment to overnight fame and fortune. But just as I started fretting about possibly being too Washington for Nashville, who should I run into but former Governor Lamar Alexander, who ran an entire presidential campaign bragging about being just the right amount of Nashville for Washington. Naturally, I asked him for advice.
My problem is I'm an inside-the-beltway kind of guy. I'm exactly what you ran against. Can I make it here in Nashville as an outsider any better than you made it in Washington that way?
You've got to feel it. But you can feel it from wherever you came from.
even inside the Beltway.
You've got more to overcome than most people.
Maybe he was looking at my blue blazer and penny loafers. But proprietor Amy Curlin told me to pay talk like that no mind. She's seen plenty of city slickers succeed and plenty of country boys with cowboy boots and big old hats squeezed by the business like a dip of snuff between your cheek and gum. All right, Miss Amy, I asked, how do I mash that button of success?
Well, something that creative that makes you different from your usual trite. Come into my arms with your charms. I've got pain because, and I'm in the rain. You don't want to be saying that. You want to be a little more original than that. My personal favorite theme in country music is I'm a guy, which makes me really dumb, and now that my woman has pointed it out to me, I'm going to be better, and because I really, really love her. That's a fine theme in country music and one that sells all the time.
Honesty. That's what it takes to write a country song. You've got to make yourself vulnerable and do it in a way in which you're telling the truth for people. Tell them what you really feel.
Meet Rivers Rutherford, an up-and-coming young songwriter who splits his time between Whistler's Music, a sophisticated commercial music production house on Music Row, and MCA Music Nashville, one of the big song publishers in town. Rivers and I would write our hit song together. It turns out that hardly anyone writes alone in Nashville. They team up, swinging from partner to partner in a sort of literary square dance. This was particularly convenient for me, inasmuch as I can neither sing nor play an instrument. Also, in terms of the themes that pervade country music, Rivers' Memphis upbringing was sure to complement my very substantial experience with big business, government, and Judaism. Or so I thought. Now, Rivers is extremely talented and a very nice guy, but frankly, a little difficult to work with. We only had one day, yet still he categorically rejected my first two ideas. One about falling in love with a lonesome cowgirl at a hearing of the House Judiciary Committee, and the other about raising the youngins. It had a catchy lyric. Papa didn't raise you to be no fool. You'd best get into a magnet school. But Rivers didn't bite, and he was at best half-hearted in trying to put a melody to my song about those losers in the 83 Camaros who cut me off on the Beltway because it's the only place on Earth where they feel in control.
They're running on empty, running behind. The faster you run, the less that you find. I think you're demons. Very worst kind. Running, running, running away from you.
I got to be honest with you. I'm looking at the lyrics. I think it's a little bit, I mean, you want to write a hit country song.
Yeah, and I'm running out of time.
Okay, yeah, we are running out of time on that, aren't we? This is probably not going to get you a number one song in the short amount of time you got. Best thing to do is find a simpler idea, I would say. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I knew all right. He was feeling threatened by the new kid on the block, by my rare insight into human behavior, by my tenderness, by my stunning command of, words. And most of all, my capacity for plagiarizing Jackson Brown. Professional jealousy is never pretty, so I just let him natter on.
Another slant on it would be to say, basically, that instead of running from these demons, what if the demon is just trying too hard or being too busy?
Okay, wait. What about this? Everyone's so busy, you know, they're running behind. What if you ever have a conversation with somebody you can't have because you're calling their voicemail and they're calling your voicemail, right?
And then phone
you're
tag.
Phone tag. And, you know, by the end of it, you're just saying, tag, you're it, right?
Okay.
So what if they're a relationship building in an exchange of voicemail messages, and the whole song was just this exchange of voicemail messages, and the hook was tag, you're it? Well, come to think of it, why not a song about telephone tag with your sweetheart? It's a common experience, harvested from my own life, completely consistent with my inside-the-beltway sensibilities, and just as the proprietor of the Bluebird Cafe suggested, it could be about a clueless guy who treats his woman wrong until she slaps him upside the head and gets him back on the road to love.
Just calling to let you know I got your message. I got your message.
a while ago. In my suitcase by the door, and now suitcase in my hand, 6 o'clock this morning. I hadn't talked to you in a couple days. The ever checking all my calls. 7 messages, yours was last of all.
Yeah, well, I mean, what if it tells a story? What story can we tell on the basis of two people who are just like electronic ships passing in the night? I love you. I think you should leave the tagger it, call me when you can, something, 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 I'm a busy man.
Tagger it, call me when you can.
All told, it took us about 6 hours, and I don't mind telling you, I was dripping with satisfaction like gravy over hot biscuits. All we had to do now was play the song for his publisher, Jody Williams, president of MCA Music Nashville. Then it would be demoed, then shopped to likely artists, Garth Brooks, Willie Nelson, what have you, and my career would be launched even as I boarded the 6.05 p.m. flight back to Washington. Rivers was a little less enthused than I was, in the very narrow sense that he thought, upon further reflection, that a song about telephone tag was pretty stupid and unlikely ever to be recorded, much less hit the charts. And Williams, before he sat down to hear the thing, was none too encouraging either.
The numbers are against you tremendously in this business. 1,000 songs a day get written in this town. 2% of those songs get recorded. Not 10%, 2%. Sometimes it's supposed to work like this. The best song wins. It doesn't always work like that. There are politics involved. There are people doing people favors.
Politics? Favors? For this I left Washington? Whatever happened to just being an artist and succeeding on your God-given talent? Tell you what, Jody, I don't need any political connections to make it in this town. Just listen to the song. Just listen to Tag You're It.
Hello and sorry, darling, I missed your call again. If you'd tried a 10 to 5, I might have squeezed you in. I really want to reach you, but time is kind of tight. I love you, hon, but I gotta run, so kiss the kids goodnight. Tag you're it, catch me if you can. I'd love to say I love you, but I'm such a busy man. I know we'll reach each other, it's just a question when. I'm calling you, but I can't get through, so try me back again. In reference to your voicemail, girl, I miss you too. You're quite correct, we should connect the way we used to do. I'll try to show that I still know what loving really means. Look for something special, hun, across your fax machine. Tag you're it, catch me if you can. I'd love to say I love you, but I'm such a busy man. I know we'll reach each other, it's just a question when. I'm calling you, but I can't get through, so try me back again. Just turned my computer on, found the email that you sent. SOS, I'm in distress, need acknowledgement. You said our ship was sinking, but the metaphor ain't right. Chips, just microchips passing in the night. Tag, that's it, believe me if you can. I'm here to say I love you, and I'm such a foolish man. We haven't touched each other since I don't remember when.
The president of MCA Music Nashville had just heard our song about telephone tag, And for a moment, he just sat there, quietly, stunned.
I've never heard that idea before.
Judging from the look in his eyes, I don't reckon he ever needed to hear it again. I was hoping for him to get a blank contract out, but instead he and Rivers went back and forth on how the song could be rewritten.
A guy who's just busy, I mean, have a mid-tempo song or have a ballad saying, our lives are, you know, this is exactly. Ridiculous, you know, and start sympathizing with each other. I don't think it's...
come up with a new hook, because Tag Your It ain't gonna
Tag Your It ain't gonna do it.
Ain't gonna do it? Tag, that's it. Believe me if you can, if I thought I was a songwriter, I'm such a foolish man. Just like that, my dreams of more than 30 hours were crushed. I guess Lamar was right after all.
You've got more to overcome than most people.
Later, as he was packing me off to the airport, Rivers spoke to me as if I were Dorothy and he were the Good Witch of the South. He could have told me that playing that song for Jody Williams would get me sent back to Washington, but I had to find out for myself. At what point did you just completely lose hope in this song?
I think at the point when you said something about, you know, we could write a song about phone tag, that's when the hope pretty much flew out the window for me.
So what you're saying was the beginning?
Pretty close to the beginning, Bob.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Yeah, Patsy, you said it. I must have been out of my mind to think I could pull this off. I can't get a record cut any more than Reba McEntire can do a 5-part series on healthcare reform. But as I sat in my airplane seat, dejected, I couldn't help but notice someone familiar sitting across the aisle. It was someone who knew not only the inside of the Beltway, but the epicenter, the ultimate Washingtonian, and yet someone equally rooted in the cultures and rhythms of the rural South. I traded seats with the Secret Service agent next to him and asked Jimmy Carter about his taste in music.
I listen to a country music station in America's Georgia, and I listen to the whole gamut of country music.
And is it possible, do you suppose, to bring a Washington sensibility to country music?
I'd be amazed.
Okay, well, then I just want to play this for you. Would you just listen to this?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. Whereupon the former President of the United States strapped on my headphones and listened to my song, flashing his famous toothy grin and, if I'm not mistaken, tapping his toe securely beneath the seat in front of him.
So what do you think? I think the song is good, and the music's good. I'd like to hear it every now and then on my country radio station. And, you know, you might get in touch with, I think the performer was very good, but if somebody like Willie Nelson or Tom T. Hall is one of my best buddies, I think they would like it and they could give you some good advice.
With your compliments?
Of course, sure.
I'll see you at the Country Music Awards, Mr. President. Upright bass, Dave Pomeroy. Robbie Turner on dobro. Tom Rohde on drums. Yeah. Aubrey Haney on fiddle. Rivers Rutherford on vocals and acoustic guitar. And ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Willie Nelson.
Hello, I'm sorry, darling. I missed your call again. If you try to 10 to 5, I might squeeze you in. I really want to reach you. Time's kinda tight. I love you, hon, but I gotta run. So kiss the kids goodnight. Tag your it. Catch me if you can. I'd love to say I love you, but I'm such a busy man. I know we'll reach each other. It's just a question when. I'm calling you, but I can't get through. So try me back again. Reference to your voicemail, girl, I miss you too. You're quite correct, we should connect the way we used to do. I'll try and show that I still know what loving really means. Look for something special, hon, across your fax machine. Tag your it,
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kossef and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Goodbye, darling.
SOS, I'm in distress. Need acknowledgement. Said our ship was sinking. The metaphor ain't right. We're not ships, just microchips passing in the night. Tag, and that's it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And Women's E-News, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.